trial in the Senate. The House is not mandated to hold an investigation. And so the conversation about the investigation that the House held, you know, whether it goes fast, whether it goes slow, whether there were sufficient witnesses, I mean, I think is a little bit of a red herring. In this particular case, there was an investigation, and I think as Manager Schiff, Adam Schiff, pointed out, you can call witnesses both in the House and in the Senate if you want to. So I think that it's interesting to sort of understand that the Senate is tasked with the trial of the impeached civil officer, in this case president, and then there are no rules for the conduct of that trial. So that when Mitch McConnell and others talk about precedents in the Clinton precedent, they make that seem as though it's hard and fast. When I heard Mitch McConnell earlier today, he seemed to suggest that he was following the Clinton playbook, but that's not constitutional. That was just his choice. And then most recently, there was a change, as you pointed out, that suddenly we're going to have 3 days of testimony, or, you know, of the whatever you call it, the
oral arguments.
Managers, oral arguments. Thank you. Oral arguments, and now the House investigation will be read into the Senate trial where it wasn't going to be before. So by that, we can see that there can be flexibility in how the Senate decides to conduct the trial, and I think it's important to remember that. The second thing that I would say, too, is that the discussion that lawyer Cipollone was talking about the, you know, stealing of an election, the impeachment is an orderly process. It's a constitutional process. Johnson in 1868 could have faced an election. It just happens he wasn't nominated, but he was planning to run again, and Trump is planning to run again. This has nothing to do with elections, which determine policy. An impeachment vote and an impeachment trial is about something else, and that's about breaking the law, to define it narrowly, or broadly speaking, maladministration and malfeasance in office. So those are just some of my thoughts.
And going through your book, I really noticed concerning the Senate trial that it was the place to be when it first began, that the Senate even had to, for the first time, print tickets in order to get in and view the trial. Now, you could, you know, it's still the same Senate chamber today. You can go in there. Right. It's free. It's usually not crowded. You can stay in there as long as the Senate's open or as long as you can stomach it, right? But for this event, this was, you know, dubbed the trial of the century, and that the Republic was on, you know, on the edge here of what would happen to the Republic. And you had who's who, especially from the political aristocracy showing up for these, you know, who got these tickets, because I guess like members of Congress and people participating were the ones.
If you knew someone, you could get a ticket. Walt Whitman knew someone, so he went.
Walt Whitman went to it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So you never know who's going to show up. Anthony Trollope, the British novelist, when he was visiting the United States, he went once. He was seen there once. So you're absolutely right. It was the trial of the century. It was the place to be. Newspapers covered even what you were wearing, particularly for women in the ladies' gallery, or what was called the ladies' gallery.
And so, women dressed up. They had their opera glasses.
They had their opera glasses, and so did the men.
And then
the journalists who were there scurried out as soon as there was a break or an opportunity to telegraph their, you know, what they had seen, what they had heard to the various newspapers for which, you know, they were writing. So it was, there was no TV, as we know, and there was no social media, but it was covered. It was extensively covered.
And then what, a week later, everyone was bored out of their minds?
Well, they became bored, and you can see how it might happen if what happens is devolution, a kind of things devolve into legal wrangling about what does you know, if you remember from Clinton, what is, what does is mean? You know, and you start getting questions about perhaps even today, what does due process mean? Who is denied due process? So that there is a lot of procedural arguments that go back and forth that do try people's patience, especially since there'd never been an impeachment trial before, and people were, you know, hoping, I think they were very anxious, but also hoping for some fireworks, and there weren't always fireworks, just as in any court of law. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of nitpicking.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first trial that you have, an impeachment trial, at least of a U.S. Mm-hmm. president. So,
right.
I mean, that took a lot. I mean, it took what we're going to witness today took them a lot longer to finally come up with how this was going to look.
Well, yeah. I mean, they actually did it fairly quickly in the sense that it was a little different. It was still partisan, make no mistake, but certainly the Republicans who were impeaching Andrew Johnson, a Democrat, they did have the majority. So it was a little different than today, where here the Republicans have a majority in the Senate, but they're not the group impeaching Donald Trump. So things could go a little bit more smoothly. But of course, the president in that case, Andrew Johnson, had very, very gifted lawyers, no doubt about it. Interestingly enough, and this may have a parallel with today, a lot of them were on record saying, well, at least in confidence, that they didn't much like Andrew Johnson, but they felt that it was their duty to perform this service for the country, or to take another tack, to, you know, protect the office of the presidency.
Now, we've talked about this a lot in previous broadcasts when the process was in the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. and that is that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson was really about the future of Reconstruction and race relations in the country.
Right.
And that Andrew Johnson was self-proclaimed white supremacist who thought the government should only be for white males. And this angered Republicans, especially radical Republicans. And I want to talk about somebody we haven't dived into a lot about this, because he was a floor manager in the Senate impeachment trial. And that is what I will call the great Thaddeus Stevens. So he wasn't always loved by his fellow colleagues back in the day from Pennsylvania. This is this is sort of the leader of the radical Republicans who, you know, made, you know, you could argue single-handedly by his control of the House Ways and Means Committee, ensured that the Civil War was about slavery, wanted full racial equality in the South after the war, wanted to ensure the military was going to remain in the South to oversee the lofty ideals of Reconstruction. He was a floor manager, but he was kind of on his deathbed, wasn't he? He had to be carried into the chamber.
Yeah. Yes, he was one of the managers. There was no way that he would miss this trial. He stayed alive almost by sheer will, and he was a very willful person. And yes, there were young men who carried him in every day. And when he wanted to read something, his voice cracked, and he would have to have another one of the managers speak for him. But he was still forced, nonetheless, because it was he who made sure that the 11th impeachment article against Andrew Johnson, the one that was very adamant about undoing the damage to the country that Johnson had done and could do in the future by denying the legitimacy of Congress and failing to execute congressional laws, particularly Reconstruction laws, particularly laws having to do with civil rights, particularly laws that granted black men in the South the vote. So he was still very, very adamant about that at that time. But he wasn't as forceful as he had been earlier when he was younger or when he was not ill. And who knows, things may have gone differently if he could have been the one who was arguing the case, instead of the very deft, very brilliant lawyer named Benjamin Butler, who did take over. But he was an abrasive figure, for sure. And, of course, there were other there were other agendas in the Senate then as there are now. But Thaddeus Stevens is a very unusual person. Just to kind of put him in focus for your listeners if they had never heard of him, the nice thing I like to sort of thumbnail sketch is when he found out toward the end of his life that the cemetery plot he bought to be buried in was in a cemetery that did not allow black people to be buried there. He immediately sold the plot and went to an integrated cemetery and said that he wanted on his tombstone words to the effect of, "I want to stand for the equal justice in death that I've always fought for in life."
He was also disabled. He had a club foot that caused him to limp, and this is a time where that actually could be used against you.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's something that would be caricatured by malicious people. And even in 1915, Birth of a Nation, if you take a look at that film, you know, which horrified many people in 1915, it still does, there was a figure based on Thaddeus Stevens who is seen to be a kind of twisted gnome-like person with a limp that was said to be a sign of the devil. Clubfoot was said to be a sign of the devil. So he's made into this diabolical figure. And that's in many cases how he came down to us through history, when history was written as a kind of lost cause, and into, I think, maybe the early 60s, when suddenly historians, and certainly the larger public, historians had already started to look at what had happened again from a different point of view.
Oh, that's interesting. I did not know that about Birth of a Nation and the betrayal of Thaddeus Stevens in that film.
Take a look at it.
I'm going to. I'm going to.
It's very, very distressing when you see, and you know, audiences would have known in 1915 for sure that that was the Thaddeus Stevens figure. And even if you take a look at Profiles in Courage, which has recently been on the front burner, that the chapter that praises Kennedy's chapter on Edmund Ross, who cast the vote that kept Johnson in office, Thaddeus Stevens there, too, is depicted by no less than John F. Kennedy or Ted Sorensen or whoever wrote that book as a kind of maniacal, diabolical figure. It's just really astonishing.
John
and that
Kennedy
was 1956. Late. I mean, you know, it seems a long time ago to us, 70 years, but still not so long ago in terms of how people think of John Kennedy, for example.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Thaddeus.
Yeah. And that comes right out of, Birth of a Nation, too, that chapter, it seems to me. But
interesting. I'm going to have to look into all of that.
You've got your homework now.
Yes, as I do every day. You just added
don't
to
we
it.
All these days, right? A lot to learn.
You know, today there are critiques, and I'm sympathetic to the critiques from the left about only impeaching Donald Trump because of the situation with Ukraine. When you have all these other things you can impeach him for, but I also kind of think back to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Thaddeus Stevens spent, two years trying to impeach Andrew Johnson, and he never had the votes for the real reason that they wanted to impeach Andrew Johnson. It wasn't until there was the violation of this very obscure law called the Tenure of Office Act that, and you could draw a line to, you know, the bigger reasons, but, you know, I mean, that was the, you know, 9 of the 11 articles of impeachment were based on the violation of this obscure law. That's inevitably what he had the votes for. So that's what he had to go with. I mean, I kind of see that now with Ukraine situation. I think there's a good argument you could and maybe should have impeach Donald Trump over other things as well, but you didn't have the votes. This is what you have the votes for.
Well, exactly. And if you take as a kind of example, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, who was hesitant and reluctant to impeach Donald Trump, much as she overtly and very strongly disagreed with so many of his policies, whether it had to do with immigration or taking children away from their parents, whether it, you know, they're just, you know, withdrawing from various treaties, whatever it happens to be. But she was very clear that you don't impeach for differences of point of view. And when the Ukraine call, the information about that was revealed, what she said was, now, this is not a question of policy, this is a question of protecting the Constitution. And what's interesting about the parallel that you're drawing, in 1868, or earlier, as you mentioned, there have been many who are horrified by Andrew Johnson's policies vis-a-vis the South and his white supremacy and his basically ability to foment violence, particularly against black citizens, or to even deny black people's citizenship. But they were reluctant. There were moderates, there were conservatives, there were progressives in the Republican Party. Andrew Johnson had the unique ability, maybe not that unique, but he had the ability to unite all elements. And when he actually broke a law that was passed to constrain him so that people in the South were safe and that they could go to the polls unmolested, then that was too much. That was a bridge too far.
I think we're going to have to leave it right there. Brenda Weinappel,
thank
you so much. Well, I'm hearing... I'm not having it on my screen, but I'm hearing voices, so we better go look into this. Brenda Weinappel, author of The Trial of Andrew Johnson and The Dream of a Just Nation. That's the subtitle. The book's actually called The Impeachers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Take care. Bye-bye.
And you are listening to KPFA's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. We did hear some voices there that had me believing that we might be going back to the Senate chamber, but, you know, it may be just that the microphones were on and somebody was speaking into them. We do have a direct feed to the Senate chamber, so that's, and it's good we keep it on there because we don't want to miss when the Senate comes back from its recess, which it will do here shortly, and which it will take up Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, his amendment to allow for the calling of witnesses and to ensure that there will be witnesses in the trial right from the get-go. Unclear whether or not there will be the votes. Unlikely, I actually would say, that there would be the votes in the Senate to pass his motion. But as I indicated, Mitch McConnell has revised his motion. Now, instead of 2 days of 12-hour each day of oral arguments for each side, now each side will get 3 days, which will likely be about 8 hours per day. And Mitch McConnell is also going, has revised his rules resolution to allow for the evidence from the House impeachment inquiry to be submitted into the record. Now, the new evidence that has come since impeachment, stuff talking about Lev Parnas or the Government Accountability Office report concerning the executive branch breaking the law, that will not be included yet. That is something that may have to be voted on a little bit later. Does look like we are getting close to the Senate coming back from its recess. John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, is now bringing the session back to order.
On Senator Schumer's amendment. Mr. Schiff, do you wish to be heard on the amendment in proponent or as an opponent? Very well. Mr. Cipollone?
Mr. Chief Justice, we are an opponent.
Okay. Mr. Schiff, you have an hour.
Adam Schiff is serving as a lead impeachment manager for the House of Representatives. He will be arguing in favor of Senator Schumer's amendment.
But I did want to take this opportunity before certain representations became congealed to respond to my colleague's argument on the resolution at large. First, it's worth noting they said nothing about the resolution. They said nothing about the resolution. They made no effort to defend it. They made no effort to even claim that this was like the Senate trial in the Clinton proceeding. They made no argument that, well, this is different here because of this or that, or they made no argument about that whatsoever. They made no argument that it makes sense to try the case and then consider documents. They made no argument about why it makes sense to have a trial without witnesses. And why? Because it's indefensible. It's indefensible. No trial in America has ever been conducted like that. And so you heard nothing about it. And that should be the most telling thing about counsel's argument. They had no defense of the McConnell resolution because there is none. They couldn't defend it on the basis of Senate precedent. They couldn't defend it on the basis of Senate history, tradition. They couldn't defend it on the basis of the Constitution. They couldn't defend it at all. And so what did they say? Well, first they made the representation that the House is claiming there is no such thing as executive privilege. That's nonsense. No one here has ever suggested there's no such thing as executive privilege. But the interesting thing here is they've never claimed executive privilege. Not once during the House investigation did they ever say that a single document was privileged or a single witness had something privileged to say. And why didn't they invoke privilege? Why only now? And even now they haven't quite invoked it. Why only now? Why not in the House? Because in order to claim privilege, as they know because they're good lawyers, you have to specify which document, which line, which conversation. And they didn't want to do that because to do that, the president would have to reveal the evidence of his guilt. That's why they made no invocation of privilege. Now, they make the further argument that the House should only be able to impeach after they exhaust all legal remedies. As if the Constitution says the House shall have the sole power of impeachment, asterisk. But only after it goes to court, in the district court, then the Court of Appeals, and then en banc, and then the Supreme Court, and it's remanded, and they go back up the chain, and it takes years. Why didn't the founders require the exhaustion of legal remedies? Because they didn't want to put the impeachment process in the courts. And you know, what's interesting is that while these lawyers for the president are here before you today saying the House should have gone to court, they are in court saying the House may not go to court to enforce its subpoenas. I kid you not. Other lawyers, maybe not the ones at this table, but other lawyers for the president, are in court saying the exact opposite of what they're telling you today. They're saying you cannot enforce congressional subpoenas. That's non-judiciable. You can't do it. Counsel brings up the case involving Charles Kupperman, who was a deputy to John Bolton on the National Security Council, and says he did what he should do. He went to court to fight us. Well, the Justice Department took the position he can't do that. So these lawyers are saying he should, and those lawyers are saying he shouldn't. They can't have it both ways. Now, interestingly, while Dr. Kupperman went to court, and they applaud him for doing that, his boss, John Bolton, now says there's no necessity for him to go to court. He doesn't have to do it. He's willing to come and talk to you. He's willing to come and testify and tell you what he knows. The question is, do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear from someone who was in the meetings, someone who described what the president did, this deal between Mulvaney and Sondland as a drug deal? Do you want to know why it was a drug deal? Do you want to ask him why it was a drug deal? Do you want to ask him why he repeatedly told people, go talk to the lawyers? You should want to know. They don't want you to know. They don't want you to know. The president doesn't want you to know. Can you really live up to the oath you've taken to be impartial and not know? I don't think you can. Now, they also made the argument that you'll hear more later on from apparently Professor Dershowitz that, well, abuse of power is not an impeachable offense. It's interesting that they had to go outside the realm of constitutional lawyers and scholars to a criminal defense lawyer to make that argument because no reputable constitutional law expert would do that. Indeed, the one they called in the House, the Republicans called in the House, Jonathan Turley, has said exactly the opposite. There's a reason that Jonathan Turley is not sitting at the table, much to his dismay, and that is because he doesn't support their argument. So they'll cite him for one thing, but they'll ignore him for the other. Now they say, oh, the president is very transparent. He may have refused every subpoena, every document request, but he released two documents, the document on the July 25th call and the document on the April 21st call. Well, let's face it. He was forced to release the record of the July 25th call. when he got caught, when a whistleblower filed a complaint, when we opened an investigation, he was forced because he got caught. You don't get credit for transparency when you get caught. And what's more, what's revealed in that, of course, is damning. Now they point to the only other record he has apparently released, the April 21st call, and that's interesting too. Now that's just a congratulatory call. But what's interesting about it is the president was urged on that call to bring up the issue of corruption. And indeed, in the readout of that call, the White House misleadingly said he did. But now that we've seen the record, we see that he didn't. And notwithstanding counsel's claim in their trial brief that the president raised the issue of corruption in his phone call, the July 5th, 25th call, of course, that word doesn't appear in either conversation. And why? Because the only corruption he cared about was the corruption that he could help bring about. Now, Mr. Cipollone made the representation that Republicans were not even allowed in the depositions conducted in the House. Now, I'm not going to suggest to you that Mr. Cipollone would deliberately make a false statement. I will leave it to Mr. Cipollone to make those allegations against others. But I will tell you this, he's mistaken. Every Republican on the three investigative committees was allowed to participate in the depositions. And more than that, they got the same time we did. You show me another proceeding, another presidential impeachment or other that had that kind of access for the opposite party. Now, there were depositions in the Clinton impeachment. There were depositions in the Nixon impeachment. So what they would say is some secret process. Well, they were the same private depositions in these other impeachments as well. Finally, a couple last points. They make the argument the president was not allowed in the Judiciary Committee, chaired by my colleague, Chairman Nadler, to be present, to present evidence, to have his counsel present. That is also just plain wrong. Just plain wrong. I'm not going to suggest to you they're being deliberately misleading here, but it is just plain wrong. You've also heard my friends at the other table make attacks on me and Chairman Nadler. You'll hear more of that. I'm not going to do them the dignity of responding to them, but I will say this. They make a very important point, although it's not the point I think they're trying to make. When you hear them attack the House managers, what you're really hearing is, we don't want to talk about the president's guilt. We don't want to talk about the McConnell resolution and how patently unfair it is. We don't want to talk about how to pardon the expression, ask backwards it is to have a trial and then ask for witnesses. And so we'll attack the House managers because maybe we can distract you for a moment from what's before you. Maybe if we attack the House managers, you'll be thinking about them instead of thinking about the guilt of the president. So you'll hear more of that. And every time you do, every time you hear them attacking the House managers, I want you to ask yourselves, away from what issue are they trying to distract me? What was the issue that came up just before this? What are they trying to deflect my attention from? Why don't they have a better argument to make on the merits? Finally, Mr. Cipollone asks, why are we here? Why are we here? Well, I'll tell you why we're here. Because the president used the power of his office to coerce an ally at war with an adversary at war with Russia, used the power of his office to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid that you appropriated and we appropriated to defend an ally and defend ourselves because it's our national security as well. And why? To fight corruption? That's nonsense, and you know it. He withheld that money, and he withheld even meeting with him in the Oval Office, the president of Ukraine, because he wanted to coerce Ukraine into these sham investigations of his opponent that he was terrified would beat him in the next election. That's what this is about. You want to say that's okay? Their brief says that's okay. The president has a right to do it. On Article 2, we heard the president, he can do whatever he wants. You want to say that's okay? Then you got to say that every future president can come into office and they can do the same thing. Are we prepared to say that? Well, that's why we're here. I now yield to Representative Lofgren.
That's Adam Schiff, and we now go to Democratic Representative Zoe Lofgren of the Bay Area. This is her third impeachment. She was a House staffer for the Nixon impeachment, served in Congress during the Clinton impeachment, and still in the House of Representatives, where she is now a floor manager. This is Zoe Lofgren.
Legitimate trial based on a full evidentiary record. The Senate can remedy President Trump's unprecedented cover-up by taking a straightforward step. It can ask for the key evidence that the president has improperly blocked. Senator Schumer's amendment does just that. The amendment authorizes a subpoena for White House documents that are directly relevant to this case. These documents focus on the president's scheme to strong-arm Ukraine to announce an investigation into his political opponent to interfere with the 2020 election. The documents will reveal the extent of the White House's coordination with the president's agents, such as Ambassador Sondland and Rudy Giuliani, who pushed the president's so-called drug deal on Ukrainian officials. The documents will also show us how key players inside the White House, such as the president's acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, and his deputy, Robert Blair, helped set up the deal by executing the freeze on all military aid and withholding a promised visit to the White House. The documents include records of the people who may have objected to this scheme, such as Ambassador Bolton. This is an important impeachment case against the president. The most important documents are going to be at the White House. The documents Senator Schumer's amendment targets would provide more clarity and context about President Trump's scheme. The amendment prevents the president from hiding evidence, as he has previously tried to do. Now, the House subpoenaed these documents as part of the impeachment inquiry, but the president completely rejected this and every document subpoena from the House. As powerful as our evidence is, and make no mistake, it overwhelmingly proves his guilt. We did not receive a single document from the executive branch agency, including the White House itself. Recent revelations from press reports, Freedom of Information Act requests, and additional witnesses such as Lev Parnas underscore how relevant these documents and therefore why the president has been so desperate to hide them and his misconduct from Congress and from the American people. A trial without all the relevant evidence is not a fair trial. It would be wrong for you senators acting as judges to be deprived of relevant evidence of the president's offenses when you are judging these most serious charges. It would also be unfair to the American people, who overwhelmingly believe the president should produce all relevant documents and evidence. Now, documentary evidence is used in all trials for a simple reason. As the story goes, the documents don't lie. Documents give objective, real-time insight into the events under investigation. The need for such evidence is especially important in Senate impeachment trials. More than 200 years of Senate practice make clear that documents are generally the first order of business. They've been presented to the Senate before witnesses take the stand in great volume to ensure the Senate has the evidence it needs to evaluate the case. Now, documentary evidence in Senate trials has never been limited to the documents sent by the House. The Senate, throughout its existence, has exercised its authority pursuant to its clear rules of procedure to subpoena documents at the outset of a trial. We don't know with certainty what the documents will say. We simply want the truth, whatever that truth may be. So do the American people. They want to know the truth, and so should everybody in this chamber, regardless of our party affiliation. There are key reasons why this amendment is necessary. We'll begin by walking through the history and precedent of Senate impeachment trials. I'll let you know about the House's efforts to get the documents, which were met by the president and his administration's categorical commitment to hide all the evidence at all costs, and will address the specific need for these subpoenaed White House documents. I'll tell you why these documents are needed now, not at the end of the trial, in order to ensure a full, fair trial based on a complete evidentiary record. Now, some have suggested incorrectly that the Senate is limited only to evidence gathered before the House approved its articles of impeachment. Others have suggested, also incorrectly, that it would somehow be strange for the Senate to issue subpoenas. These claims are without any historical, precedential, or legal support. Over the past 2 centuries, the Senate has always understood that its sole power under the Constitution to try all impeachments requires the Senate to sit as a court of impeachment and hold a trial. In fact, the founders assigned sole authority only twice in the Constitution. First, giving the House sole authority to impeach, and second, giving the Senate sole authority to try that impeachment. If the founders had intended for the Senate to serve as some kind of appellate body, you know, they would have said that. But no, instead they wrote this. Article 1, Section 3, the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. The Senate has always received the relevant documents in impeachment trials, and indeed, the Senate's own rules of procedure and practice make clear that new evidence will be considered. Precedent shows this. All 15 full Senate impeachment trials considered new evidence. Let's look at a few examples that show the Senate takes new evidence in impeachment trials. The first ever presidential impeachment trial in 1868 against President Andrew Johnson allowed the House managers to spend the first 2 days of the trial introducing new documentary evidence. It was the same in Judge John Pickering's trial in 1804. New documents were presented to the Senate nearly a week before House managers made their opening statement and later throughout the trial. And, as been mentioned earlier by Mr. Schiff, in modern times in 2010, George Porteous's impeachment trial included 7 months of pretrial discovery and 6,000 pages of documentary evidence admitted at trial. After that evidence was admitted, the Senate held its trial. President Clinton's case did not involve subpoenas for documents. Now, why was that? Because President Clinton had already produced a huge trove of documents. The independent counsel turned over to Congress some 90,000 pages of relevant documents gathered during the course of his years-long investigation. And I remember as a member of the Judiciary Committee going over to the Ford building, looking at the boxes of the document. But even with all those documents, the Clinton trial included the opportunity to present new evidence and the admission of additional documents and 3 witnesses. The Clinton impeachment precedent also shows how President Trump's refusal to produce any relevant documents in response to congressional subpoenas is different than past presidents, different from President Clinton, different from President Johnson, and less even than President Nixon. In short, not a single president has categorically refused to cooperate with an impeachment investigation. Not a single president has issued a blanket direction to his administration to produce no documents and no witnesses. These are the precedents the Senate must rely on. The Senate should issue a subpoena for documents at the very outset of the proceedings so that this body, the House managers, the President, can all account for those documents in their presentations and deliberations. It doesn't make sense to request and receive documents after the parties present their cases. The time is now to do that. So why is the amendment needed to prevent President Trump from continuing his categorical commitment to hide the evidence? In this case, the House sought White House documents. Why don't we have them? It's not because we didn't try. It's because the White House refused to give them to us. The president's defense team seems to believe that the White House is permitted to completely refuse to provide any documents without regard to whether or not it is privileged. They apparently believe that Congress's authority is subject to the approval of the president. But that's not what the Constitution says. Our Constitution sets forth a democracy with a system of checks and balances to ensure that no one, and certainly not the president, is above the law. Now, even President Nixon produced more than 30 transcripts of White House recordings and notes from meetings with the president. Here, even before the House launched the investigation that led to this trial, President Trump rejected Congress's constitutional responsibility to use its lawful authority to investigate his actions. He asserted that his administration was fighting all the subpoenas, proclaiming, "I have an Article 2, where I have the right to do whatever I want as president." Here is what he said.
"Then I have an Article 2, where I have the right to do whatever I want as president."
Even after the House formally announced its investigation of the president's conduct in Ukraine, the president still continued his obstruction. Beginning on September 9, 2019, the House investigative committees made two attempts to voluntarily obtain documents from the White House. The White House refused to engage with, frankly, or even respond to the House committees. On October 4th, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform sent a subpoena to White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, this time compelling the production of documents from the White House by October 18th. On October 8th, before the White House documents were due, the White House counsel sent a letter to Speaker Pelosi stating the president's position that the President Trump and his administration cannot participate in this partisan inquiry under these circumstances. The president simply declared that he will not participate in an investigation he didn't like. 10 days later, on October 18th, the White House counsel sent a letter to the House confirming that it would continue to stonewall. The White House counsel again stated the president refused to participate. Well, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, says that the House shall have the sole power of impeachment, just as in Article 1, Section 3, the Senate has the sole power to try. Participation in a duly authorized congressional investigation isn't optional. It's not up to the president to decide whether to participate or not. The Constitution gives the House the sole power of impeachment. It gives the Senate the sole power to try all impeachments. The president may not like being impeached, but if the president, not the Congress, decides when impeachment proceedings are appropriate, then the impeachment power is no power at all. And if you let him block from Congress and from the American people the evidence to cover up his offenses, then the impeachment power truly will be meaningless. With all the back and forth about these documents, we've heard the phrase executive privilege. The president and his lawyers keep saying it. They talk about vast legal rights to justify hiding the truth, withholding information, but that's a distraction. That's not what the Constitution provides. And the truth is, as has been mentioned by Mr. Schiff, in the course of the entire impeachment inquiry, President Trump has not once asserted executive privilege, not a single time. It was not the reason provided by Mr. Cipollini for refusing to comply with the House's subpoena. Indeed, President Trump didn't offer legal justification for withholding the evidence. Here's the truth. Presidents, members of Congress, judges, and the Supreme Court have recognized throughout our nation's history that Congress's investigative power are at their absolute peak during impeachment proceedings. Your powers. Executive privilege cannot be a barrier to give absolute secrecy to cover up wrongdoing. If it did, the House and the Senate would see their power disappear. When President Nixon tried that argument by refusing to produce tape recordings to prosecutors and to Congress, he was soundly rebuked by the other two branches of government. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled against him. The House Judiciary Committee voted that he be impeached for obstruction of Congress. It would be remarkable for the United States Senate to declare, for the first time in our nation's history, that the president has an absolute right to decide whether his own impeachment trial is legitimate. And it would be extraordinary for the Senate to refuse to seek important documentary evidence, especially when the president has yet to assert any privilege to justify withholding documents. Now, there's another reason this amendment is important. The documents sought are directly relevant to the president's misconduct. The White House is concealing documents involving officials who have direct knowledge of key events at the heart of this trial. This isn't just a guess. We know these documents exist from the witnesses who testified in the House and from other public release of documents. And let's walk through those specific documents that the White House should send to the Senate. They include, among other documents, relating to President Trump's direct communications with President Zelensky, President Trump's request for political investigations, including communications with Rudy Giuliani, Ambassador Sondland, and others, President Trump's unlawful hold of the $391 million of military aid, concerns that White House officials reported to NSC legal counsel in real time, the president's decision to recall Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch from Ukraine. The first set of documents the Senate should get about President Trump's communication with the president of Ukraine would include the phone calls on April 21st and July 25th, as well as the September 25th, 2019 meeting with President Zelensky in New York. We know, for example, that NSC officials prepared talking points for the president in preparation for both calls with the Ukrainian president. The talking points were about American policy, as reflected by the votes of Congress, as well as the Trump administration itself. They didn't include any mention of the Bidens or the 2016 election interference or investigations that President Trump requested on the July 25th call. Here's a clip of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman explaining how the president ignored the points about American policy, reflecting the views of both the Congress and the Trump administration.
Colonel Vindman, if I could turn your attention to the April 21st call, that is the first call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Did you prepare talking points for the president to use during that call?
Yes, I did.
And did those talking points include rooting out corruption in Ukraine?
Yes.
That was something the president was supposed to raise in the conversation with President Zelensky?
Those were the recommended talking points that were cleared through the NSC staff for the president, yes.
The materials provided for the July 25th call that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman mentioned are highly relevant. They could help confirm that the president's actual statements to President Zelensky were unrelated to the foreign policy objectives of his own administration and show that they served his own personal interests at the expense of America's national security interests. These documents also include handwritten notes and other documents that White House officials generated during the calls and meetings. We know, for example, that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Mr. Morrison, Jennifer Williams, all testified to taking contemporaneous handwritten notes during the July 25th call. Ms. Williams and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman both testified that President Zelensky made an explicit reference to Burisma that was not included in the memorandum that the White House released to the public. Here's a clip of their testimony.
Both of you recall President Zelensky in that conversation raising the issue or mentioning Burisma, do you not?
That's correct.
Correct.
And yet, The word Burisma appears nowhere in the call record that's been released to the public. Is that right?
That's right.
Correct.
Why do you need documents generated after the calls and meetings? They would shed light on how these events were perceived in the White House and what actions were taken moving forward. For example, National Security Advisor John Bolton wasn't on the 25th call, but he was apparently informed about the contents of the call afterward. His reaction, once he was informed, would be helpful to understanding the extent to which President Trump's action deviated from American policy and American security interests. There's another set of documents that the Senate should get, and they relate to the political investigations that President Trump and his agents repeatedly asked Ukrainian officials to announce. These documents about efforts to pressure Ukraine to announce investigations and the decision to place a hold on military aid to Ukraine, they would be very important for you to evaluate the president's conduct. For example, Ambassador Bolton is a firsthand witness to President Trump's abuse of power. He reported directly to the president. He supervised the entire staff of the National Security Council. Public reports indicate that John Bolton is a voracious note taker in every meeting. From witness testimony, we know that Ambassador Bolton hosted the July 10th, 2019 meeting where Ambassador Sondland told Ukrainian officials that the promised White House meeting would be scheduled if they announced the investigations. We know Bolton was briefed about this meeting immediately following it when Ambassador Sondland said he had a deal with Mick Mulvaney to schedule the promised White House meeting if Ukraine announced investigations into the Bidens and the 2016 election. We also know Ambassador Bolton was involved in briefing the president on a presidential decision memorandum in August, reflecting the consensus interagency opinion that Ukrainian security assistance was vital to America's national security, something the Congress had approved, appropriated, something the president had signed. Press reports indicate that he, too, was involved in a late August Oval Office meeting where he, Secretary Pompeo, and Secretary Esper all tried to convince the president to release the aid. Now, Ambassador Bolton has come forward and publicly confirmed that he was a witness to important events, but also that he has new evidence that no one has seen yet. If we know there is evidence that's not yet come out, all of us should want to hear it. We should want to hear it now. Before Ambassador Bolton testifies, we should get documents and records relating to his testimony, including his notes, which would provide contemporaneous evidence about what was discussed in meetings related to Ukraine, which would help to evaluate his testimony. The evidence is not just restricted to Ambassador Bolton. During his public testimony, Ambassador Gordon Sondland stated, "I have not had access to all my phone records." He also said that he and his lawyers had asked repeatedly for these materials. He said the materials would help refresh his memory. We should look at that material. Ambassador Sondland also testified that he exchanged a number of emails with top officials like Mick Mulvaney about his efforts to pressure Ukraine to announce the investigations President Trump demanded. Here's his testimony.
Third, let me say, precisely because we did not think that we were engaging in improper behavior, we made every effort to ensure that the relevant decision makers at the National Security Council and the State Department knew the important details of our efforts. The suggestion that we were engaged in some irregular or rogue diplomacy is absolutely false. I have now identified certain State Department emails and messages that provide contemporaneous support for my view. These emails show that the leadership of the State Department, the National Security Council, and the White House were all informed about the Ukraine efforts from May 23rd, 2019 until the security aid was released on September 11th, 2019.
These emails, among others, are in the possession of... These emails referenced in this testimony are in the possession of the White House, the State Department, and even the Department of Energy, since officials from all three entities communicated together. You know, during his testimony, Ambassador Sondland described it this way. Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. These emails are therefore important to understanding the full scope of the scheme. The request for relevant evidence is not confined to Trump administration officials. The Senate should also get White House records relating to the president's private agents who acted on his behalf in Ukraine, including Rudy Giuliani, Victoria Tensing, and Joe DiGenova. Witness testimony and documents have made clear that Mr. Giuliani, a frequent visitor to the White House who also received and made frequent calls to the White House, was acting on behalf of the president to press Ukrainian officials to announce investigations that would personally and politically benefit the president. For example, the May 10th, 2019 letter from Mr. Giuliani to President-elect Zelensky that's shown on this slide, states he was acting, quote, as personal counsel to President Trump with his knowledge and consent. He requested a meeting with the president-elect and he to be joined by Ms. Tensing, who is, quote, very familiar with this matter. The evidence indicates he was collaborating with Ms. Tensing and Mr. DiGenova in this effort. The Senate should get the White House records of meetings, of calls involving Mr. Giuliani, Ms. Tensing, or Mr. DiGenova. These records are important to help you understand the extent to which the White House was involved in Mr. Giuliani's efforts to coerce Ukraine to announce the investigations the president wanted. The records would also show how the president's personal political agenda became more important than policies to help America's national security interests. The president's counsel may, consistent with his prior attempts to hide evidence, assert that attorney-client privilege would cover these documents. But the president's personal attorney-client privilege cannot shield evidence of misconduct in office, or that of his aides, or of his lawyer's participation in corrupt schemes. We aren't asking for documents reflecting legitimate legal advice. You need documents about their actions to pressure Ukraine to announce an investigation into President Trump's political opponent. There's a set of White House documents that relate directly to the president's unlawful decision to withhold $391 million appropriated bipartisan to help Ukraine. Witnesses have testified that President Trump directly ordered a hold on the security assistance despite the unanimous opinion of his agencies that the aid should be released. Importantly, according to the Government Accountability Office, his action violated the law. On January 16, 2020, the GAO, an independent watchdog, issued a legal opinion finding that President Trump violated the law when he held up security assistance to Ukraine. The GAO said, and I quote, "Faithful execution of the law does not permit the president to substitute his own policy priorities for those that Congress enacted into law. OMB withheld funds for a policy reason which is not permitted under the Empowerment Control Act. The withholding was not a programmatic delay. Therefore, we conclude that OMB violated the ICA. The fact that the president's action to freeze the aid, which he used to pressure Ukraine to announce the political investigations he wanted, was against not only the official consensus of his own administration, but also against the law, and it was to help himself. That helps demonstrate these actions were taken for President Trump's personal and political benefit. Witness testimony and public reporting make clear The White House has a significant body of documents that relate to these key aspects of the president's scheme. Some of these documents outline the planning of the president's freeze. For example, the New York Times reported in June that Mr. Mulvaney emailed his senior advisor, Mr. Blair, "Did we ever find out about the money for Ukraine and whether we can hold it back?" This shows that Mr. Mulvaney was in email contact with his aides about the very issues under investigation as part of this impeachment. It tells us that the White House is in possession of communications that go to the heart of the charges before you. The Senate should also get materials prepared for summary notes from a late August meeting with President Trump, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, when they tried to convince the